But how about taking in the picture show tonight?
Maggie, me girl, nothing would suit your old man better than taking you out for an evening's pleasure. But I'm gonna be pretty much tied up tonight.
Patrick O'Grady, you promised. No more cards for them rowdies down at Sullivan.
And who mentioned cards? I got a job of work to do in a clock.
What are you talking about? Our clocks is all right.
Oh, this is a... Look, ain't it a little beauty now?
What's the likes of you doing with it?
Well...
Likes of you doing with it?
Well, got talking to the little friend she made at the house.
She give you the clock to remember her by, I suppose.
Nothing to the sun. The talk just got around the clocks, and I told her I was handy with them. Then she gave me this clock belonging to the lady of the house to
That's
fix.
It's a fine state of affairs. There's more to this than meets the eye. A friend she made, huh? And she wraps you around a little finger.
The lady of the house was there, too. She said I should take and fix it.
Then she must be as crazy as a loon. Who ever heard of giving a clock to a coal mine to fix?
Clock repairing may seem a rather unusual occupation for a coal man, but it would appear that we are about to venture even further into the field of unusual vocation. For our science reporter says he's going to spend considerable time on this excursion in science, proving that superstition is a business. Just how he came by this particular line of thinking, I'm not sure, so perhaps it would be wisest to ask him to step forward and start explaining. Ladies and gentlemen, Emerson Markham.
Thank you, Bob Stone, and how do you do, everyone? I had some rather unusual things pointed out to me regarding superstitions by John R. Saunders, Associate Curator of the Department of Education at the American Museum of Natural History.
But what did he have in mind when he called superstition a business, Emerson? The fact that lots of people spend good money on fortune tellers and so on?
Well, partly that, Bob. Americans spend at least $125 million on fortune tellers every year. That's about a dollar apiece. But Mr. Saunders pointed out that we may be sure that some of us spend much more than that. More millions are spent each year in this country on mystic charms, love potions, hoodoo bags, and the like.
Well, that's really big business for the capital B, isn't it?
Indeed it is. And when we stop to realize the hidden costs of superstitions, the effect superstitious beliefs have upon our national energy and upon our standard of living and upon our health, the thought is a staggering one. Superstitious beliefs even add to the cost of our daily bread.
A bread? Come now, Emerson.
Well, I'll prove my point before I finish, Bob. You see, superstition didn't die out after the Middle Ages. It's just as much in evidence today as it ever was. And those educational agencies which are using the weapon of truth, of accuracy, are well aware of the battle which confronts them. Museums have been waging war on superstition, and they realize that the fight is a tough one.
Yes, but hasn't science been waging a winning battle on superstition, Emerson?
I don't know about the winning part, Bob. Man is a queer creature. Black cats, ghosts, and goblins have often frightened him out of his wits. But he manages to bolt down contradictions, inconsistencies, and paradoxes without batting an eye. Perhaps we can't serve science and superstition, but there are plenty of folks willing to give it a try.
I suppose you could class belief in ghosts as superstition. Will I enter our discussion?
Yes, indeed, Bob. For downright persistence, for antiquity, for universality, the belief in ghosts has no rival in those superstitious beliefs which plague mankind. So firmly does this belief rest with us that even today there are very few people who would not hesitate to rent a haunted house or take a shortcut through the cemetery at midnight. To be perfectly honest, most of us would probably agree with that astute French woman who said, I do not believe in ghosts, but I am afraid of them. Fear is behind most superstition, you see. And if we could only achieve complete freedom from fear, we would find very little superstition left in the world.
Yes, but how are you going to explain ghosts to people who believe in them?
To be sure, all kinds of queer things happen in Ghostland. Material objects move without the application of any apparent force. Transmediums speak, revealing information outside of their normal knowledge. Strange noises are heard, and apparitions are seen. How can we explain them? Well, most folks would say ghosts. A small minority of emancipated moderns might answer in another word, fraud. But there are other pigeonholes into which we can file these facts, you know. They are labeled illusion, hallucination, extrasensory perception, and coincidence, just to mention a few.
There's another superstition I'd like to have discussed. That's one about spilling salt being bad luck. How about that?
Well, today salt is cheap and common. What does it matter if we spill a bit or a whole box full? Those of us who are superstitious will say, of course, that it's bad luck to spill salt. They will point out that you can avoid calamity by throwing a pinch of salt over your shoulder, and some may even insist that you should burn some on the stove. but salt hasn't always been cheap and common. Early man used little salt. He may not even have known of its existence. He ate his food raw, or else he roasted it. But his troubles began when he invented pottery and discovered agriculture. He began to boil his meat, and he added plant food to his diet. And then he began to crave salt. But in those days, there were no corner grocery stores.
In other words, salt was difficult to come by?
Right. It was rare and precious. Even today, there are primitives who will describe a wealthy man as one who always eats salt with his victuals. To spill salt was a calamity, but a calamity is not a superstition. Salt was not only precious, it was sacred. The ancients thought it had magic. It became a symbol of the home, of friendship, of hospitality. It was incurring the wrath of the spirits to waste such a precious and magic substance. Hence, when one was careless enough to spill salt, a libation or offering had to be made to placate the spirit, you see.
It's pretty true, isn't it, that many superstitions have antidotes, like throwing salt over your shoulder if you spill some?
Yes, fortunately for the credulous, even though they labor under the unhappy threat of all kinds of omens, there are antidotes for most unlucky omens. For example, if you cut your nails on Friday, you cut them in woe. But you don't have to cut them on Friday. If you start anything on Saturday, you'll never live to finish it. But why start anything on Saturday? You don't have to kill spiders or place your shoe on a shelf above your head or take the last piece of bread on the plate. You can be careful. You can still say bread and butter when a post comes between you and your companion. You can knock on wood when you catch yourself boasting. You can say God bless you when someone sneezes. Oh, indeed, you can work like a beaver on watching out for your luck and preparing the proper antidote when you slip. But it's much easier to laugh at the whole mess of superstition and have none of it.
Well, I must mean the elephants we always remember. You mentioned something about superstition affecting the cost of our bread some time back, remember?
Well, it's this way. Mr. Saunders told me that he's met many farmers who still hold to the superstitious belief that milk snakes milk cows. These farmers kill all of the milk snakes they can find, and in so doing, they bring on an increase of mice which plague their barns, eat their feed, and spoil their harvest. The fewer milk snakes, the greater the number of mice on which the snakes feed. The more mice, the less grain in the barn. The less grain, the higher the cost of bread. You can tell one of these credulous farmers that it's a physical impossibility for any snake to milk a cow, and yet they will persist in their belief. Superstition is strong and not too easy to dislodge once it gets a hold on the mind of credulous people. And don't forget that we are all pretty credulous one way or another.
Well, is there anything we can do about superstition?
First of all, we're not too squeamish about our logic, Bob. We tend to be conservative creatures, and we hold quite tightly to old beliefs and customs and trinkets long after we have learned better, and long after their original purpose has been lost or forgotten. Then, too, even with all of our knowledge and science, civilized life is still insecure, precarious, and uncertain. So you see that superstition is only one chapter in man's long search for security. Security will smash superstition. When we get rid of the fear that goes with insecurity, we will have conquered superstition. As Mr. Saunders pointed out, museums play their part in explaining for man the world in which he lives. But man must eke out his own security. And when he does this, superstition will fade away. Do you feel funny when you see a black cat at night? Do you hesitate to walk under a ladder? Have you a lucky number? Do you carry a charm? Does the sight of an umbrella in the house frighten you? If you answered yes to any of these, then you're superstitious.
Then what?
Well, don't worry too much about it. Most of us are. See if you can't get a good laugh out of it. Laugh at your superstitions. Don't let them laugh at you. Laugh at them. And then try to reason them out, and then forget them.
We'll remember what you've told us, Emerson, and probably if we're wise, we'll let some of it sink in. And ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to have a copy of a paper by John R. Saunders, Associate Curator of the Department of Education at the American Museum of Natural History, a paper which contains more facts and stories about superstitions than we've had time to bring you here, all you have to do to get your copy is address your request to Excursions in Science in care of the station to which you are now listening, asking for scientific paper number 231, entitled Superstition is a Business. That's scientific paper number 231, Superstition is a Business. Your copy will be put in the mail for you free of charge. And now, once again, we come to that portion of our program regularly devoted to the answering of the scientific questions which you listeners have sent in. These inquiries come from people like ourselves, laymen with a curiosity about the world in which they live. The answers are as scientifically sound and up-to-date as answers can be, since they are based on facts provided by staff members of the General Electric Research Laboratory, or other equally trustworthy institutions. Emerson, here's the first communication. It comes from a lady who writes, I have a pint of 5% DDT and would like to know more about using it than the directions on the bottle, 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 than the directions on the bottle. I put some around window frames with a chamois. The chamois went to pieces and flies still come in. Is the DDT injurious to cloth or paint?
Well, for the complete answer to our friend's problem, it's necessary to know whether the 5% DDT is a petroleum solvent solution or a water emulsion. However, for a residual spray, the 5% DDT should be sprayed quite evenly over a considerable area of walls. Depending upon the quantity applied, its effect will last from several days to 2 or 3 months. DDT is not an insect repellent and therefore will not keep flies out. It will kill them as they light on it, but its action is slow, sometimes taking as long as 24 hours.
Is DDT injurious to cloth or paint, Emerson?
DDT itself, a dry white powder, is not injurious to paint. In fact, it is sometimes incorporated in paints. Neither is it injurious to cloth or chamois. However, the solvents used may occasionally attack paint, and emulsifying agents in emulsions might have a bad effect on chamois.
Now here's a chance for you to try your hand again in the household hint department. This lady writes that she has an old clock with painting, a landscape, on the glass of the lower front. Now, the paint is coming off. Is there any oil or other preparation, she asks, that I can apply to save the picture?
A clear lacquer may answer the purpose, Bob, but we'd better add this word of warning. The lacquer may cause the paint to curl up, so it would be best to try it on a corner to see that it doesn't lift the paint before entirely covering the picture.
This letter reaches us from Franklin, Pennsylvania. The gentleman asks, if a man is riding on the rear platform of a train traveling 150 miles an hour and fires 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 150 miles an hour in opposite direction, where would the bullet lodge?
Well, neglecting such factors as turbulence of air around the rear of the train, Bob, the bullet would drop to the ground in a vertical line below the point where it left the muzzle of the gun.
Next, we come to this one. It's from a registered nurse who writes that she has trouble removing canned orange juice stains from bed linen. She'd like to know how to remove it.
Well, we'd suggest that our listener try sodium hypochlorite, which is sold under various trade names. Hanging the bed linen out in the sunshine and wind after linen out in the sunshine and wind after linen out in the sunshine and wind after warning, sodium hypochlorite should be used only on white cotton, not on wool.
Another correspondent wants to know how the acre and mile were invented and where.
Oh, well, now, acre was originally the amount of land that could be plowed by a yoke of oxen in a day, Bob. The word itself is derived from the word meaning a plowed field. It was a variable measure, however, until statutes were passed during the reigns of Edward I, Edward III, and Henry VIII of England, limiting its area to a piece of land 40 poles long by 4 broad. That is, 160 square rods. A different acre is used by the Scotch and the French in various small localities today.
Very interesting, Emerson. How about the mile, now?
Mile originated at the time of the ancient Romans, whose measure of distance was milia passuum, meaning 1,000 paces. This mile differed from the present-day mile because it was only approximately 1,620 yards, while the present-day mile is 1,760 yards.
Another man writes, rubber under tension is crystalline in structure. Is the wall of a soap bubble also crystalline? Then he adds, I suppose the X-ray would reflect or refract if crystalline.
In some cases, the soap bubble seems to be crystalline in the sense that the molecules are oriented. There are times when the soap film seems to show a solid property or characteristic, and this is particularly true with the so-called black film, which is a very thin film made up of probably less than 10 or 15 layers of molecules. It's hardly likely that the X-ray would produce usable results, since soap films have very little absorptive properties from the standpoint of X-rays. But electron diffraction could be and has been used to study films of this nature.
And now we come to this one. The gentleman asks, has the temperature at which such inert gases as helium solidify, that is, melting point, been theoretically determined? If so, how?
Oh, all of these gases have been liquefied and solidified experimentally. Their melting points have been determined, not theoretically, but by actual practice. These are the melting points of various inert gases. Helium, minus 458 degrees Fahrenheit. Neon, minus 415 degrees Fahrenheit. Argon, minus 308 degrees Fahrenheit. Krypton, minus 251 degrees Fahrenheit. And xenon, minus 170 degrees Fahrenheit.
And speaking of low temperatures, we'll probably find it pretty chilly around here if we don't start making preparations for leaving. Our time's just about up, leaving just enough for me to say thank you, Emerson Markham, and good day. Thank you, Emerson Markham, and goodbye, everyone, until our next excursion in science.